Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world, and happy Monday, everybody. Today is June 29th, 2026. We're back at the studio today after a nice vacation, and we have got some big news this morning in crypto and in AI, and the two are kind of related because there's a lot of dotted lines and interconnectivity between the two. So let's start with Strategy. They're selling Bitcoin and they're buying back stock. That's interesting. We've got a press release from Michael Saylor, Strategy, formerly known as MicroStrategy, whatever. A lot of people still call him MicroStrategy. What's the gist of it? They are establishing a US dollar reserve, a minimum of 1 year worth of dividend coverage for their preferred equities like Stretch, which we've talked about a lot, combined with a minimum of 1 year of debt service costs. So Strategy is basically saying we've got to keep at least this much cash in the bank at all times to cover dividends and debt service for a year. All right, that sounds good. It sounds responsible. We're going to maintain liquidity. They're also going to repurchase up to $1 billion of digital credit securities. Digital credit securities, yeah, Stretch. Their preferred equity stock that pays out this dividend. They're going to buy back $1 billion of it. Okay, that's interesting as well, right? Because Stretch is trading at like, or it was trading like $72 last week, $74, something like that. So they're going to buy that back. They're going to bid up the price to closer to $100, which was the par value that they advertised, or they suggested that it would never dip below, even though it went way below that. So they're going to buy back up to $1 billion of that, and buying it back both brings the price back upward towards par, and it also reduces their dividend expense because those shares go bye-bye when you buy them back. All right, that sounds great. All good news. How are they going to pay for it? Ah, that's the rub there. They're going to pay for it the way we all knew they were going to pay for it, by selling Bitcoin. That's kind of important. They're calling it the Bitcoin monetization program. Oh, I'm sure that polled very well in focus groups, because when you tell hodlers we're selling Bitcoin to pay for all this shit, well, that doesn't go over so well with the people who you told never, ever sell your Bitcoin. Well, when you're selling your Bitcoin, yeah, that's not going to go over so well with them. And look, this is how the infinite money glitches become the doom loop. And we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now. When Bitcoin was going up during Bitcoin summer, day in and day out, Bitcoin goes up higher and higher. Then Saylor and his infinite money glitches, where he issues stock or borrows money to buy Bitcoin, which sends Bitcoin higher and then makes his stock worth more. Rinse, repeat. The infinite money glitch, it only works as long as Bitcoin keeps going up forever. When Bitcoin goes down, which it does do every couple of years, crypto is on a very predictable summer-winter cycle. And right now, we are in the dead of crypto winter. Well, when Bitcoin stops going up and it starts going down, that infinite money glitch becomes a doom loop where you have to sell Bitcoin to pay for the debt service cost and the dividend that you used to buy it. That news of you selling Bitcoin drives Bitcoin's price lower, which causes more people to dump your stock and your stupid preferred shares. Then you have to sell even more, rinse, repeat. It's all just been financial engineering. There's really nothing underlying this company other than this degenerate gambler moving paper around. That's really all there is to it. Bitcoin is actually not reacting very hard on this news. It's currently sitting just below 60,000, where it's been for a couple of days here. Now, guys, we've got several months of Bitcoin winter left, right? And in my opinion, which is based on prior Bitcoin cycles, we probably won't see the bottom until sometime between September and November of this year. And that's typically, you know, couple of months before the next Bitcoin halving, which would happen in 2028. So can Saylor survive the next few months? Probably. How would he survive it? By selling the Bitcoin he needs to cover all of these expenses. Does that Saylor selling of Bitcoin trigger the sell-off that causes the doom loop to accelerate? That's the big question there. Ultimately, I think Bitcoin will be fine in the long run, but it's going to be volatile in the short term. We've also got Bitcoin ETFs are dumping Bitcoin here. $4.1 billion of outflows in the month of June. That is people not just selling their Bitcoin ETFs, but people redeeming their Bitcoin ETFs and then selling the underlying Bitcoin. So you've got, again, the infinite money glitch. During the run-up, ETFs buying Bitcoin caused the price to go up, caused people to pile into Bitcoin ETFs. So they issued more shares. They bought even more Bitcoin, rinse, repeat. Well, now Bitcoin is going down. People are selling and redeeming the shares of the Bitcoin ETFs. And so they're selling, adding selling pressure on the way down. Basically the same thing with MicroStrategy. Now, as all of that is going on, we've got my favorite subject, the AI bubble. And we've got the Bank of International Settlements is getting involved now. If you guys don't know who the BIS is, the Bank of International Settlements is basically the central bank for central banks, or the biggest financial body in the freaking world. Yeah, them. They're out warning of an AI bubble that could cause a financial crisis. And, you know, hey, BIS, welcome to the party, pal. You know what? You're only about 3.5 years behind me on that one. Nice. Yeah, well, you know, the largest financial regulatory body in the world and their thousands and thousands of PhDs, they were going to get around to it eventually. They can't be expected to keep up with one guy with a bachelor's degree in engineering working out of his corner office in freaking nowhere, Pennsylvania. Anyways, they're saying disappointment in returns could trigger a sudden pullback in financing and turn the CapEx boom into a protracted investment bust. Yikes, disappointments in returns. Well, nobody saw that coming. They're also talking about knock-on effects on financial conditions. Basically, this could cause a liquidity crisis where lending dries up because everybody goes on defense and then companies start failing in that situation. And they're also saying that a major equity market correction this time around could trigger stronger macroeconomic consequences than prior investment busts. In other words, this could be worse than the dot-com bubble. Why would it be worse? Because this time around, the average person in the world, in particular in the United States, has way more exposure to stocks than they did back then. Americans, the percentage share of Americans' household wealth that is currently in the stock market is higher than it has ever been. And so if there's a big downturn in the stock market, Americans' wealth will go up in smoke faster than ever. And that could affect how they spend and how they behave. We could see a drawdown in consumption. In other words, the Bank of International Settlements is saying, they're also warning about circular financing, you know, biggest financial fraud in human history, that it could cause a major economic calamity. Groundbreaking stuff from the Bank of International Settlements. And again, way to get out in front of that one, BIS. Way, way out in front on that one. All right. Other stories going on this morning. Speaking of malinvestment and lack of returns, Samsung and SK Hynix are going to spend $800 billion to build chip fabs in South Korea just in time for that bubble that's about to burst. You got the U.S. and Iran had another weekend war and a Sunday peace deal. It's almost like there's a rewards program now if you can start and stop a war inside of 3 days before the market opens on the following Monday. So many times in a month, you win a free oven mitt or something. I don't know. Again, Axios is claiming that they've agreed to sit down and talk, and the Iranians are saying that's not true. Stop me if you've heard this one. We've got Comcast is spinning off more of their media businesses. They're just slowly selling off pieces of themselves until eventually you'll be left with that cable company that's about to die. You've got a perfect storm in the auto market. This is an interesting article here. Population decline and affordability, or lack thereof, combined make for bad news in the auto market. And we've got to wrap out the show. We've got Sergey Brin, the world's third richest man and the founder of Google. He lost money in New York City commercial real estate. In particular, he lost money in rent-controlled multifamily properties in New York City. That's something that I've spent a lot of time talking about recently, warning about recently, but wait until you see how much money he lost, or at least the percent that he lost on that deal. Pretty wild stuff from one of the world's richest men on something that I have been warning about. And hey, Mayor Zohran, Comrade Zohran, he got the rent freeze that he wanted in New York City. We talked about that last week. So you can get ready for more stories like this. Guys, we got a lot to talk about. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. But first, I implore you, I beseech you, please hit that like button. You new guys, hit that subscribe button so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. Right now, the S&P 500 is up 51 points, or 0.69% in the green this morning. We've got the Dow is higher by almost 0.5%, 244 points to the upside for the Dow Jones. And the NASDAQ is up 317 points, 1.09% higher. People buying them tech stocks again this morning. The dollar is a little bit weaker this morning, 11 basis points in the red here at 101.25, although the dollar has had a strong couple of weeks since Kevin Warsh took over at the Fed. Looking over at the bond market, things are looking quiet here this morning. 30-year yield at 4.858. That's lower by almost one basis point. The 10-year yield is at 4.377. That's higher by a half a point. The 2-year yield is at 4.108, higher by 2 points and change. And the 1 month is down by just a fraction of a point at 3.676%. Looking over at commodities, we've got metals are in the red again this morning. Spot gold is at $4,047. That's lower by 41, almost 42 bucks, or 1% in the red. Spot silver is at 58.66, lower by 51 cents, or 0.86%. It has been a rough couple of months for silver, but I still like the shiny. Copper's lower by a half a percent. Platinum's lower by 2.7%. Palladium lower by 0.2%. And WTI crude is higher this morning by a whopping 89 cents. 1.29% higher, $70.12 a barrel for August WTI crude. After, you know, another war in the Middle East, we had Iranians were shooting at boats, and then we shot at the Iranians who were shooting at the boats, and then they shot at us who were shooting at them for shooting at the boats. And then, of course, in a shocking turn of events, we all agreed to sit down at the peace table again right before markets opened on Monday. And then, of course, the Iranians said, no, that's not true. So, yeah, basically the same thing that's been happening over and over again for several months. Now, let's talk about Bitcoin this morning. A lot of Bitcoin news. We're currently sitting here right around $60,000. $60,171 is priced on Coinbase. We're testing this support level here. The low that we hit back at the beginning of February, I'm afraid if we break through this level, we're going to be looking at another rapid decline here. And this story may be something that could lead to that. Strategy authorizes $2 billion in buybacks and up to $1.25 billion in Bitcoin sales for reserve. The company made no Bitcoin purchases last week, leaving its holdings unchanged at 847,000 Bitcoin. Strategy has authorized up to $2 billion in share and preferred security repurchases and approved a Bitcoin monetization program that could generate up to $1.25 billion to bolster its U.S. dollar reserve as the software company. Are we still calling them a software company? Okay. As the software company moves to strengthen its capital structure and support its preferred stock offerings. That's according to Digital Credit Capital Framework unveiled on Monday. The new framework establishes a board-approved cash reserve policy, updates the dividend policy for its stretch preferred shares, authorizes up to $1 billion of repurchases for digital credit securities, and another $1 billion for Class A common stock, or MSTR shares, and creates a Bitcoin monetization program. Yeah, a Bitcoin monetization program. They're selling Bitcoin. Why don't they just say we're selling Bitcoin? Oh, that's right, because that might panic people. Under the monetization program, Strategy may sell Bitcoin to generate up to $1.25 billion for its U.S. dollar reserve, replenish cash used for dividend and interest payments, or finance repurchases of preferred securities and common stock. The company said any Bitcoin sale outside those purposes would require additional board approval. Now, here's the thing about this Bitcoin monetization program. It's going to be ongoing sales of Bitcoin because those expenses for dividends on stretch and the expenses for debt service costs, those are not one-time expenses where you pay them and they're like, oh, good, great, I'm glad that's behind us. No, next month you got to pay them again. So they have created the mechanism for ongoing sales of Bitcoin in order to pay these increasingly large expenses. And so they're saying, you know, we're going to maintain up to $1.25 billion in this reserve. We're going to maintain at least a year's worth of dividend payments, a year's worth of debt service costs. And we're also going to buy back shares of Strategy, shares of Stretch. And it makes sense why they're going to buy back Stretch, because it's currently trading, or at least before this announcement, it was $74.57. When historically they told people, oh, this is just like a money market, and we're going to pay you these big 11% dividends, and we're going to have these AI-generated women in bikinis sipping on Mai Tais by the pool talking about how rich they are because they invested in Stretch. Oh, shit, 25% of my capital just went up in smoke. But my 11% dividend, yeah, it's not such a great investment. So they have to do this. They have to do this to stop the bleeding in Stretch. And they're probably going to get sued anyway, but this is all about, you know, getting out in front of these lawsuits. Now, this morning, since this announcement and that they might be buying back the stock, you've got some people are buying Stretch here. It's up about $6, trading at $81.15. But again, the par value that they marketed this at was $100. And, you know, the gist of it was, if it goes below $100, we'll either buy it back or we'll raise the dividend to bring that price right back up to $100. And if it goes over $100, we'll issue more shares, diluting the value, and then buy Bitcoin with that. And then, of course, Bitcoin's price started going down and Stretch just tanked on that news. Guys, this is basically a debt instrument with an unsustainable yield from a guy with a history of blowing up companies, a degenerate gambler, and he never has to pay you back the principal. That's ultimately what you bought if you bought Stretch. And they definitely marketed this to low IQ, low information investors. And I had the pleasure of meeting some of those folks on Twitter over the last few weeks. They're a fun bunch of guys. Good luck with this one. And even as that's going on a strategy, we got Bitcoin ETFs set for worst month with $4 billion in outflows. And again, guys, I'm not horribly like bearish on Bitcoin. I own some Bitcoin, not as much as I used to because I knew crypto winter was coming. I plan on buying more when I'm convinced that winter is nearly over. I think it's going to get worse for a couple of months before that happens. So again, I'm not one of those Bitcoin is going to zero guys. But at the same time, I'm also not one of those hodler who's saying Bitcoin to infinity next week. U.S. listed Bitcoin exchange traded funds are on pace for their worst month of withdrawals since launching 2 years ago. Investors have pulled more than $4.1 billion from the 13 funds in June, the highest net outflow since the product started trading in January of 2024. IBIT, the BlackRock fund with the most assets under management alone, accounted for $3 billion of those withdrawals. The outflows come as Bitcoin itself is on track for its worst monthly performance since June of 2022. It's basically the last crypto winter, when a chain of crypto businesses went bankrupt, culminating in the downfall of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX. The token is down more than 18% this month, hovering around $60,000 since falling through that level last week. Again, guys, winter, we have not seen the worst of it yet. In my opinion, it won't be over until this fall. Meanwhile, we've got the Bank of International Settlements is warning on my favorite topic, the AI bubble. And they say AI bust risks ripple effects from growth to credit, BIS says. And again, the Bank of International Settlements, that is the central bank for central banks. That is a big outfit. An artificial intelligence bust, inflation, and fiscal stress are among the most alarming threats to global prosperity at present, the Bank for International Settlements warned. In its annual report published on Sunday, the Basel-based institution cited those on a list of pressure points that currently demand attention, with underlying financial vulnerabilities lurking that could amplify any shock. The global economy remains caught in the cross currents of progress and peril, Basel officials said in the report. Resilience is being increasingly tested and strained. The assessment highlighted AI-led risks prominently in a report that arrived on the eve of the European Central Bank's three-day annual symposium in Sintra, where a host of global policymakers will also scrutinize such stability dangers closely. Disappointment in returns could trigger a sudden pullback in financing and turn the CapEx boom into a protracted investment bust with potential knock-on effects on financial conditions, the BIS said, before observing that a major equity market correction could have larger macroeconomic consequences today than in the past. And the reason they're saying that is because people today have more exposures to stocks than at any time in history. And so a major stock market crash would hurt the average person more than it did in years past, which could affect their consumption. It could affect the number of vacations or their decision to buy a new house or a new car. The Basel officials went on to note that other assets could face similar dangers and highlighted credit in particular. Repricing of risk this time, whether triggered by high interest rates or an AI bust, has the potential to be similarly disruptive in that segment to the 2008 financial crisis, the BIS said. Now, I've heard a lot of comparisons to the dot-com bubble, but this is the first time I've heard anybody say the AI bubble could be as big as the GFC. Holy shit. On AI specifically, officials highlighted vulnerabilities linked to funding, including complex arrangements such as so-called circular financing deals that can mix equity and debt with supplier-client contracts. Again, Bank of International Settlements, really riveting, groundbreaking stuff, talking about the circular financing in AI. I mean, you guys are really way out in front on that one. keep up the good work. Sarcasm detected maybe a little bit there. Okay, for instance, chip makers and hyperscalers take stakes in AI labs or neocloud providers who in turn commit to multi-year purchases of chips or computing power, the BIS said. Data center construction is more frequently outsourced to third parties that lease facilities back to hyperscalers on long-term contracts with embedded exit clauses. The terms of such deals are typically poorly disclosed, with risks of the same asset being pledged multiple times. Oh, this is just so much fun. I cannot wait. When we start doing the post-mortem and the Monday morning quarterbacking on this bubble and everybody's like, oh, this was so predictable. Of course, this all failed. Remember, all the people who told you for the last 3 years how crazy I was and what an idiot I was for citing this stuff, they're all going to claim that they were the ones who saw it coming. Mark my freaking words, but don't worry, I'm not bitter. I'm really bitter about it. But anyway, maybe I should write a book about that or something. Hint, hint. But you know what? You got more good money chasing bad money because Samsung and SK Hynix, they're going to spend $880 billion to drive Korea's AI lead. South Korea is orchestrating investments of at least 1.35 trillion won, or $880 billion, from companies including Samsung and SK Hynix into chips and data centers, a giant outlay in digital infrastructure it called essential to surviving the AI era. In other words, keeping the bubble inflated. Samsung and SK Group said they plan to build two chip-making plants apiece in the Southwest for a total of 800 trillion won to rapidly expand production capacity to meet increasing demand. South Korea also announced 550 trillion won of investment from companies including internet leader Naver Corp to build 8.4 gigawatts of AI data center capacity by 2029. The country aims to double its memory production capacity within 5 years and secure world-class manufacturing capabilities to pull far ahead of competing nations, the industry ministry said. South Korea must move faster than its global rivals to secure leadership in chips, data centers, and physical AI, President Lee Jae-myung said in a briefing where he called the Samsung and SK Hynix leaders national heroes. All right, as long as they're not putting all their eggs in the same AI basket, everything should be fine. Bit of foreshadowing there. Meanwhile, we had another silly war over the weekend. U.S. and Iran agree to halt attacking each other ahead of talks. And even that, U.S. and Iran agree to halt attacking each other. Apparently, they haven't even agreed to that because the Iranians are out saying, no, we didn't agree to anything. The U.S. and Iran have agreed to stop attacking each other before peace talks resume this week over the Strait of Hormuz and other issues, paving the way to end days of tit-for-tat attacks that tested a fragile truce. A U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity said technical talks are scheduled to continue on all aspects of a memorandum of understanding reached this month, adding that both sides will stand down for now and vessels can move freely. The exchange of attacks began Thursday over the waterway through which a fifth of the world's oil and gas once flowed, with the Islamic Republic striking a container ship. This prompted Washington to hit Iran the following day. The U.S. struck again overnight Saturday after Tehran attacked a vessel carrying Qatari oil. Both sides blamed the other for breaching the ceasefire. Didn't I say this on Friday morning? Didn't I say that this war was gonna flare up any minute now? But don't worry, it'll be over by the time market opens on Monday. I'm pretty sure I said that exact thing. If I didn't, I was thinking it. Good God, this is so predictable. The violence ratcheted up tensions in the wake of this month's interim U.S.-Iran peace deal and risks slowing progress toward restoring traffic through the vital strait to pre-war levels. In the latest barrage on Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it launched missiles and drones at the Ali al-Salem Air Base in Kuwait and the 5th Fleet Naval Base in Salman Port, Bahrain. Kuwait said it intercepted two missiles and there was no material damage or injuries. Bahrain reported a residential building had been hit but said there were no fatalities. The U.S. said on Saturday it struck Iranian military sites. And Javier Blas is on X. He's pointing out the same thing. Javier Blas is the energy and commodities columnist at Bloomberg. He says Middle East wars are now scheduled from 9 p.m. Friday to 10:30 p.m. Sunday. That's it. The fighting outside designated non-market hours isn't allowed. If y'all could have your wars when markets are closed, yeah, that'd be great. Meanwhile, Comcast plans to spin off NBC Universal into a new media firm. Comcast has been doing this quite a lot lately, spinning off their TV networks and now their studios. Comcast said it plans to separate its media business from its cable TV and internet operations, spinning off NBC Universal and Sky into a new publicly traded company in a bid to increase value. Comcast shareholders will have stakes in both companies. The company said in a statement on Monday, the separation is expected to take place in a year and requires board and regulatory approvals. NBC Universal will have the same dual-class share structure as Comcast, giving the Roberts family an outsized say in management of both companies. The split will help the two companies focus on separate strategic priorities as both face new competitive pressures and challenges. NBC Universal will hold the theme parks division, Universal Film and Television Studios, the NBC and Telemundo broadcast networks, Peacock streaming service, and Bravo cable channel, as well as the European media business Sky. The remaining Comcast will hold the company's broadband, wireless, and cable TV business. Philadelphia-based Comcast has struggled recently, however, as consumers shift to streaming TV and cancel cable TV subscriptions. At the same time, newly energized telecom companies such as AT&T and Verizon have been winning more broadband customers by offering high-speed internet service through wireless and fiber optic lines. Comcast put in an offer for rival media company Warner Brothers Discovery last year in an attempt to bulk up, but Roberts has largely been in deconstructing mode recently. Comcast spun off its cable TV networks such as MS Now and CNBC into a new company, Versant Media Group, at the start of this year. Shares in that company dipped initially and have largely traded sideways since, reflecting the ongoing drag on cable viewers and advertising. So Comcast doing pretty good this morning on this news. The stock is up. Well, okay, it's up 8% now. The stock was up more than 21% at one point this morning. So we have since given back a lot of that spike here, only up 8% now. Still a good morning for Comcast shareholders. $25.15, higher by $2 on a stock that has lost 56% over the last 5 years. Meanwhile, we've got a perfect storm points to a much smaller U.S. auto market by 2040. We've had no shortage of stories about how bad things are in the car market here. This article does a pretty good job of capturing what's really driving that trend. 10 years ago, a record 17.6 million cars, trucks, and SUVs were sold in the U.S. Some forecasts say the country might not come close to that number again. Analysts at consulting firm Bain & Company said several signs indicate the market is about to shrink even more. Falling birth rates, behavioral changes, high car prices, and a growing array of alternatives could drive sales down by more than 2 million units by 2040, according to their analysis. These indications point to a future where automakers fiercely compete for a shrinking number of customers, said Mark Gottfriedson, a partner at Bain & Company. The auto industry has historically depended on an annual 1% growth rate that tracks the increase of the overall population. But all over the world, government statistics show population growth has slowed, and some countries are already seeing declines. It is the perfect storm, isn't it? Gottfriedson said. It starts with the population declines. You're no longer a growth industry. You're a declining industry. You're a declining industry at a time when the technology is disrupting everything. The U.S. fertility rate in 2025 was about 1.6 births per woman. While not as low as some countries in Europe or Asia, it's considered below the replacement rate of 2.1, according to the Centers for Disease Control. The remaining population's behavior has changed also, in part due to high prices and affordable alternatives, according to Bain. Half of 16-year-olds today don't have a driver's license, compared with nearly 70% of 16-year-olds between the years 66 and 84. That stat might reflect a mere delay rather than a total refusal. Bain's research suggests people still get licenses by age 25. Still, the share of new vehicle registrations among people age 18 to 34 fell from 12% in the first quarter of 2021 to under 10% by mid-2025. Buyers 55 and older account for nearly half of all new registrations and have held the largest share for 8 straight quarters. It's the same thing in the housing market. Young kids just can't afford cars. They can't afford houses. They can't afford cars. The engine behind it is affordability, said Craig Deitch, founder and president of Telemetry, a firm that does market research for the auto industry. New vehicle monthly payments are up 30% over 4 years, and nearly 1 in 5 new vehicles carries a payment over $1,000 a month. We wonder why cars just aren't selling. And look, people are waiting longer to buy cars. They're driving them less once they have them, largely because of work from home. And that leads to stories like this one. Shout out to my friend, the Pasta Man, who sent me this. Michelin to close BF Goodrich tire plant in the U.S. by the end of 2028. Fewer cars on the road, fewer miles being driven. That means tires are being worn out less. And so tire factories are closing. That, by the way, is 1,200 people who will lose their jobs at some point in early 2027. And last but not least, Sergey Brin's steep loss highlights New York landlords' pain. And this is a story I've been warning about for a while. I think this story is about to get a lot worse thanks to Comrade Mamdani's rent freeze that just went through. Ballooning costs for and strict limits on rent increases have spurred losses for many investors in New York City apartments, among them the world's third richest man. And don't get me wrong, Sergey can afford it. He's not going to have to skip any meals here, but that's not the point here. Google co-founder Sergey Brin offloaded his stake in a New York real estate fund for pennies on the dollar last year after its bets on rent-stabilized apartments soured. Amphitheater LLC, an entity affiliated with Brin, sold shares in the fund that holds nearly 5,900 units back to its manager, A&E Real Estate, according to documents filed in December. A&E bought out one of our long-term investors who was willing to accept 6 cents on the dollar of their original equity investment to divest itself from the New York City multifamily sector, a representative for A&E said in a statement. 6 cents on the dollar. He lost 94% of his money on his investment in New York City multifamily real estate. And that was last year before Mamdani's rent freeze went into effect. You think that's going to make things better or is that going to make things worse? The election of Mayor Zohran Mamdani, who campaigned on lowering the cost of living for New Yorkers, has increased the pressure on landlords. The city's rent guidelines board voted Thursday to freeze increases on the city's approximately 1 million rent-stabilized apartments, a key plank of Mamdani's 2025 campaign. The simple and deeply troubling fact for renters is that institutional capital, both equity investors and lenders, are fleeing New York City's rent-stabilized apartment sector, the A&E representative said. They understand New York is in a doom loop. Because when these landlords lose that much money, they stop making repairs on those buildings, and those buildings become even more run-down, decrepit, rat and bedbug infested than they were before. And unfortunately, that doesn't mean good things for the people who live in those buildings, although that's what's being sold to them with these rent freezes. Guys, New York City multifamily real estate, I think we're going to be hearing a lot about this in the months ahead. I think, I said my piece on that one. Hey, everybody, I just want to say thank you very much for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Hey, we got a soundboard again. Let's hit that music. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out so you can have your coffee with us tomorrow as well. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. Links down in the description should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.